Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Just under 4 weeks until Election Day, and yep, there's another twist in the 2020 presidential election cycle. The president has been hospitalized now for COVID-19, and Joe Biden's campaign has responded to the news by taking down negative ads. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Jackie Borchardt, State House reporter for the Cincinnati Enquirer. Welcome back, Jackie.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Kathy Kandiski, the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be here as well.
And Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back.
Always fun to be with you.
All righty. So there's been conflicting information over the weekend about the president's condition, but he appeared healthy enough yesterday to go for a ride and greet his supporters outside the hospital. What did you make of those optics, Joe?
Well, you know, I have to question all of this. You know, we see the CDC guidelines saying you're supposed to quarantine for 14 days. President Trump is under the care of doctors in that hospital. I don't know of too many hospitals that would allow just an ordinary person who gets COVID-19 to go walking out the door and parading down the street while they're in the care of that hospital. And further, it's almost as if these COVID-19 rules that were regulations that were set in place by the CDC, by the way, these are regulations or recommendations that are applied supposedly to everyone, but it seems like there's a certain class of people who those don't apply to right now. And I think, you know, a lot of voters are noticing that.
And also there's been some criticism out there, Kathy Kandiski, that, you know, he's forced Secret Service agents to be in a hermetically sealed car with him. Ostensibly, they have to now quarantine for 14 days, right?
Correct. There was an interesting tweet last night, I think it was, from one of the physicians at Walter Reed, not someone on the president's physician staff, who tweeted just that concern that he
That's
unnecessarily
right.
put his Secret Service people at risk by putting them in a car with him and parading around. And who knows how many other people have been in close proximity with the president, even while he's at Walter Reed. So, yes, ostensibly they have to quarantine for 14 days now. It's kind of mind-boggling.
Yeah, and I'm just wondering about everybody else that works for him in that capacity that was on Air Force One, anywhere around him. Before he was diagnosed, Jackie.
And I would add, yeah. And in your intro, you noted that he was in Ohio. He hadn't notified. You know, Governor DeWine
right.
said yesterday that he had not been notified yet. He came into contact with people when he was at the debate in Cleveland and it appears, although the timeline is a little confusing at this point, it appears that he may have been contagious at that point.
Exactly. Because they're speculating that it was from that Rose Garden event for the nomination of the Supreme Court to the Supreme Court. So, Jackie Borchardt, the Biden campaign has taken down negative ads during this time. Can you talk about the calculus there? Somebody said, well, immediately you get all the debates about whether negative ads work or not and that kind of a thing. What do you think about it?
Well, this campaign, it seems, is maybe more about which candidate you don't want to win than which one you want to win, which I got the feeling talking to a lot of voters 4 years ago, too. There were a lot of people who were, voting against Hillary Clinton or
holding their nose,
not voting
kind of
for
a thing,
her
yeah.
or not voting for Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, negative ads can help. They can work. And, we have two very known, well-known candidates. I haven't looked into the polls too deeply, but I would guess that the percentage of people who say they don't know much about either candidate is very low.
Mm-hmm.
They already before they took down the ads or around the time that the Biden campaign said that they were already getting some criticism from the Trump campaign for running them while he was in the hospital. So it's one of those things where it's not a great look. But I don't know if he's well enough to take a drive around and greet his supporters, and if he's gonna slingshot out of the hospital and go back to campaigning like his aides say he will be. I don't think that they need to hold them back much further if that's going to be the case. But we really don't know. I mean, you raised a great point before. Not only is the timeline of things in question, but details of the president's condition and how he has been in the last couple of days have been also hard to get out and contradictory over the weekend.
Right. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Jackie Borchardt. She is a bureau chief for the Cincinnati Enquirer State House Bureau. Also with us, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau and Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch. We are talking about the big news. BBC's got it at the top. I guess it's big international news. The president has been diagnosed with COVID-19. It's pretty unclear what his status is. They've not been very forthcoming with many details, which is unusual at this point. Joe Ingles, I wanted to get your thoughts about negative campaigning and the calculus of taking down negative ads at this point.
Well, you know, we need to point out that President Trump has some negative ads out there right now. So, you know, not all negative ads have disappeared from the airwaves, but taking the ads down right now, those ads, that could actually benefit Joe Biden as well, because you don't want to appear like you're beating up on someone who, has a problem that they can't, deal with. And the fact that the president is sick, that might actually, having those negative ads out there might actually sway some voters against Joe Biden at this point, if he goes too hard against the president. But the fact is that this president is, as we've already pointed out, is intending to go back out there very soon on the campaign trail. And if that's the case, I don't know that it's really a big deal whether the ads were pulled or not.
Because if he goes on the campaign trail, he's back to Sleepy Joe references and 47 years of doing nothing and all the other stuff he says.
Exactly.
Hmm. The vice presidential debate is scheduled for Wednesday. I'm wondering what you think, Kathy Kandisky, if Kamala Harris brings up the president's medical status as a topic, and if so, how she, what you make of that as a topic in and of itself?
Well, I would have to say absolutely. I mean, the one thing that's changed with the president's diagnosis is now the COVID-19 pandemic is front and center in terms of issues for the presidential election. So yes, I expect her to bring it up a lot. And what it does is raises questions about Trump's handling of the pandemic. And of course, Pence has been in charge of the task force that the president put together to deal with this. And one of the things I expect her to bring up is just how frequently they're meeting, because they really haven't been holding any press conferences or anything like that in recent weeks. The task force itself, we haven't heard from the medical doctors or anything like that. So I expect it to be a prominent subject matter during the debate. Absolutely.
What do you think, Jackie Borchardt?
Yeah, I agree. You know, Pence has had a hand in the administration's, a pretty big hand in the administration's response. He has calls with the different state governors regularly to try to, brief them on what the feds are doing to help the states. And I think to this debate, if it happens, I've already seen some people questioning whether it can happen, given that the vice president was in contact with some of these people who we're learning now are COVID positive.
Mm-hmm.
But if it happens, it vice presidential debates are not usually the main attraction. They're not exactly always memorable, but this one could be. It's possible that maybe we don't have another presidential debate, and this becomes kind of a pivotal moment for both campaigns. So I think the pressure is on them a little bit, given that the president has already canceled several. He was supposed to have rallies in the last couple of days. He was already in the middle of a pretty intense campaign schedule. He had been in the week prior to his diagnosis, been to several states and held fundraisers and rallies and also official presidential events. So yeah, with him in the hospital, or even if he's discharged and recovering at the White House, he won't be able to be the person out in front. So it's going to be on the vice president to kind of help carry that message and pick up the campaign.
What do you think, Kathy Kandisky?
About what?
About the vice presidential debate, and what if there's any topics that are off, if there's anything that's off the table because of the president's diagnosis.
I really don't. I think one of the things you're seeing from the White House right now is they're trying to rewrite the narrative a little bit. You know, Trump has been largely dismissive of the virus and downright, you know, negative about wearing masks, often making fun of the vice president Biden for doing so. I think what we've seen over the weekend is that the president's aides, and I would expect we'd see this from Pence as well in the debate, are trying to talk now about the president thinks it's important to wear masks and wants everybody to wash their hands. You know, you hear this now and you're just like shaking your head, but what they're trying to do, I mean, I think it's important from their perspective to try and portray that the president is taking this serious now and has, from their perspective, been taking it serious all along. So that's a lot of what I expect.
Coming up, we have a few more issues to deal with from what the president talked about at the debate last week, including how Ohio had the best year ever in 2019, despite job reports that suggest otherwise. So stay with us. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. That was Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch. Also with us, Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau and Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer, Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, and Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. At the first debate, Donald Trump said that Ohio had the best year ever in 2019, despite job reports that suggest otherwise, that the state had its biggest job losses since 2009. So what is your sense about how Ohio voters are feeling about the economy and who should get credit? What are you seeing out there, Joe Ingles?
Well, you know, I think the thing is you can make numbers say anything you want to. So I think both sides can use those job numbers and come up with a narrative that works for them. I think the real thing that matters is how Ohioans feel about their job situation. And we see right now that the Biden campaign has been going up in Lordstown and taking some of these workers who have been displaced, and they're talking about, you know, how difficult it's been. One comes to mind, the woman whose husband is in another state, and they go back and forth on the weekends and that sort of thing. I think, you know, those kind of stories resonate with people more than numbers. And the more that the campaigns talk about stories about the people that are affected by job losses or job gains, I think that's the thing that we're going to see people react the most to rather than these numbers.
In the Lordstown case, Kathy Kandisky, the president went so far a few years ago as to say, don't sell your houses if their jobs are going to come back. Of course, they haven't. Is there some ammo there?
I think for a lot of voters in that area, you will see some backlash on Trump, but it's just to say how much, because a lot of people I've been talking to are actually, you know, are sticking with him despite what would seem to be, a poor impact on their own personal, you know, economic status. It's kind of mind-boggling.
And Jackie Borchardt, Ohio's been put into the toss-up category. How much do you think that has to do with the situation at, you know, the likes of Lordstown, the GM plant closing there, and those kinds of job numbers?
I think that's certainly a factor. That's a part of the state where it had been reliably Democratic for many, many years. And we saw the president made huge gains in mm-hmm. the eastern part of the state and in the valley. And that's been a question, you know, ever since 2016 is, you know, what is going to happen in that region here? But look, you know, Ohio is more diverse than just one region. It's kind of seen as a strength of ours. And one reason why we're considered a bellwether state is we have, you know, several large cities. We have a lot of rural area and we also have suburban mm-hmm. areas. And the suburbs have been yet another focus because as we've seen in the last several years or even decades, Republicans have really strengthened their position in the rural parts of Ohio, and Democrats have done the same in the urban areas. And so what that leaves to battle over are the suburban areas. And as we saw in 2018, some of those areas went blue after electing Republicans for several years. So the question is that trend from 2018 going to continue into this election, especially when we have a candidate like Trump, who is a very unique candidate? He's not a traditional candidate in any really sense of the word. And even though he is a Republican, his appeal is kind of beyond the party label to many voters. So I think the Valley is part of that, but I think a lot of the focus this election cycle has been on those suburban areas.
You know, I might just point out, Anne, real quick, mm-hmm. that unlike we're talking about the Youngstown area and some of these working class areas, I think Joe Biden does a lot better with voters in those areas than Hillary Clinton did. I think that's one of his strong suits. So I would not be surprised to see him making up some ground in those areas, although I totally agree with Jackie about the importance of the suburban areas.
Right.
You know, it's a real battleground.
Trump has been using the big city politics as kind of a blunt instrument to Kathy, kind of generalizing about who the leadership is in the big cities. What do you think the calculation is there? Because the fact of the matter is there's a lot of voters in big cities.
There are, but I think his message is really being directed more at suburban voters in terms of you're next. This is coming to your suburbs if we don't get a mm-hmm. handle on it. I think that's more of what the message from the president has okay. been. I've spent a lot of time in the suburban areas talking to voters, in the last few weeks, and I have yet to find one who shares that concern that the suburbs are going to somehow be overrun. But that seems to be, to me, that seems to be who the president's directing that message to.
And then there's been a lot of talk to Joe Ingles about suburban women and the power they wield 100 years now after women got the vote in the United States. What do you make of that, the focus? There's always the soccer mom, there's the suburban women, you know, there's always some euphemism for the female vote.
Right. I think, if that debate was meant to attract suburban women, I think it was way off the mark, because I don't think that the president did anything to endear himself to suburban women. I'm not sure, we talk about suburban women. I'm not sure exactly who that mm-hmm. encompasses, because I think President Trump uses that differently than Joe Biden. But when you look at women in the suburbs and that vote, they tend to want more reasoned kind of arguments. They tend to want to, look at where the candidate actually stands on things that affect their lives. Mm-hmm. And right now, they're not hearing a whole lot from President Trump on that. And he's the one that really has to go after those suburban women in order to succeed.
And as well as using the big city leadership, like a blunt instrument in the campaign, he's also still, I mean, he has, well, let's just talk about the white supremacy issue and what how that resonates in a place like Ohio, Jackie Borchardt, and his unwillingness to disclaim or separate himself from it. Instead, it's told, you know, to stand back and stand by.
Yeah, that moment, I think maybe more than any other, and that debate stood out as a low moment. I'm thinking in terms of this suburban women vote that we're talking about. And I think mm-hmm. Joe is right that the suburban women vote kind of is a euphemism for you know, women who are maybe college educated, have families. I think there's a sense that it's white women, but you know, demographics show that the suburbs have diversified well beyond being a white flight or place where white people leave the city and, mm-hmm. and settle with their families. And I think they want the reasoned arguments, but also this idea of civility. You know, they're not ready to let go that of the idea that civility is still a thing that can happen and that you can have political disagreements with people and still be their friends and their neighbors. And the debate really put kind of that on display. There's the divisiveness and kind of nastiness that politics has become in many corners. And that statement above all else, I mean, it's like the easiest thing you can do at this point, especially after everything that's happened in the last couple years and over the summer. So, you know, the president did later, I think it was the next day or the day after, you know, told reporters, like, of course I, you know, condemn these things, but it's the moment that you needed to do it. You needed to do it on TV.
When the whole world is watching, right?
Right. In front of millions, because the fact that you didn't then became, I think, probably the biggest news out of that debate and kept, you know, reverberating for several days.
Let's turn back to the Ohio returning to a toss-up status in the polls. I'm wondering how, Kathy Kandisky, given your years of experience covering these things, how it'll play out in terms of campaign appearances, advertising, polling, fundraising, all of that stuff in Ohio.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of us Ohio reporters were bummed when we you know, weren't a closely watched state or considered a swing state anymore, because that meant no more campaign visits. And I think early in the campaign, that's what you saw. There weren't as many candidates coming to Ohio, if at all. We were getting like second and third level surrogates, you know, Don Jr. and the likes of that. Now that the race has tightened up in Ohio, is the last poll I saw was it was a dead tie. Now we're seeing the candidates coming to Ohio, and also maybe the thing that most people are noticing are the campaign ads that have stepped up on TV. So those are the two things that you can expect to see a lot of. You know, when Trump gets back on the campaign trail, I expect him, you know, the upper Midwest is going to be the real focus for a lot of the candidates at this point.
And for all intents and purposes, the president can't campaign for a couple weeks, right, Joe Ingles?
Well, he's not supposed to. However, I don't think he was supposed to be doing what he did yesterday with the joyride in the car either. So here's the thing, though. I mean, I think a lot of people are looking at this situation with the president and the way that he's handling coronavirus, and they're thinking that, hey, wait, he's got his family refuses to wear the mask at the Cleveland Clinic debate. And, you know, he's doing these things that, you know, joyriding in the car and doing things that other people who have coronavirus don't do.
They're not allowed to do it.
Right. They can't. They're not allowed and they're not able. I mean, you know, most people are very sick with this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're sitting here with a lot of voters who may not have solid health care. They may, you know, they're looking at the difference in treatment that they get if they get sick with this versus what's happening in Washington, D.C. This has a potential. All this stuff that's happening right now has a potential to backfire because people are looking at it saying there's one set of rules for them and there's another set of rules for me.
You know, I was thinking about that. Yeah, I was thinking about that in terms of Chris Christie. And he found he was diagnosed with COVID-19 and checked himself into a hospital with an abundance of caution. And I'm thinking, gosh, Kathy Kandisky, can everybody just check themselves into a hospital and know that it's going to be covered and just out of caution?
Absolutely not. I mean, that I don't know what the protocols are more recently, but early on in the pandemic, I was hearing that you really weren't supposed to show up to a hospital unless you were having breathing difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once the disease had progressed or once your condition had deteriorated to a certain point, clearly with Chris Christie and also with President Trump, they were hospitalized immediately. And if you believe what they say for preventative measures, but certainly to kind of get a jump start on treatment and trying to get ahead of the progression of the disease. So it seems quite different than what the average person goes through. And I know it's difficult just to get in to see your regular doctor. You've got, most of them are requiring you to go to get a COVID test and wait for the results for a day or two before they'll see you for something like, a strep throat or any kind of other illness you may have. So I think it's a real contrast.
Let's switch gears now, because there's always a lot of voting questions. We're going to have another voting show coming up on Monday, I believe. But right now I wanted to talk about the 10th District Court of Appeals last week ruled against a trial judge's order requiring Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose to allow ballot applications by fax or email. That returns the case to the Franklin County Common Pleas Court. Who among you, are any of you guys covering this or watching it?
No. Yes. So it's still weird to not be able to look around the room and nod.
I miss you guys. I really miss the reporter roundtable in person. So was that Joe?
I think all three of us have probably been watching him pretty carefully. We're just trying to figure out who should jump in on it. I think, we're getting down to the wire on these court cases.
Yeah.
And it's pretty clear right now where Secretary of State LaRose stands on this. I don't see a whole lot, early voting begins tomorrow. And so it becomes much more problematic to change things in process.
Right.
So I don't think we're going to see a lot of changes coming about anytime soon.
And by the way, today's the last day to register to vote in Ohio.
Correct.
Yeah. So early voting starts tomorrow. Today's the last day to register. If you haven't registered yet, you still can. Just get out there and do it. Fewer new voters have registered in Ohio this year than in 2016. Have you guys looked at, I don't want you all to say something at the same time again. So I'll say Jackie Borchardt, what do we know about who's requesting ballots? What's out there and what's expected on election day and leading up to it?
Yeah. Rick Ruan at the Dispatch had a story looking at how voter registration has been kind of weird this year because we're in the middle of a pandemic, and the groups that actively try to sign up people to vote are not able to do a lot of things that they normally do, like go to parades and festivals and, stick a clipboard in someone's hands and go to college campuses and set up a table and talk to the students as they walk past. It's just those things are so normal in any other time, but really can't be done now. But they're still trying to register people to vote and trying some, creative ways to do that, drive up voter registration, that sort of a thing. But we're kind of behind, I guess, where we were 4 years ago. However, there's usually a kind of rush in the last few weeks. So we won't know for sure a couple of days or a week or so where we're at as far as how many new voters have signed up to vote in this election. Absentee ballots, ballot requests have been off the charts. I don't have the most recent number in front of me, but it was approaching 2 million, I think. So we're, way ahead of where we were 4 years ago. And what we've seen is that of the voters who are affiliated with a party, in the state, which you don't have to be in Ohio, but if you've picked up a primary ballot that affiliates you with that party, and we've seen that more Democrats are requesting ballots to vote by mail, absentee. And, you know, I think that's probably for a couple reasons. You know, the Biden campaign and the Democratic Party have been encouraging people to vote absentee. You know, I think anybody in Ohio who was voting in the primary probably feels like maybe it's a good idea to request a ballot, given what happened in March, where, you know, the night before the election day was postponed, and we essentially turned to a vote by mail election a month later. So absentee voting by mail has been a thing in Ohio for more than a decade, almost two decades. And it's something that some people regularly do. It's something that most people don't, but we're definitely expecting a huge surge in voting by mail this year.
There are other election-related lawsuits, and there's also the question, among which are the question about whether or not you can have more than one ballot box in a county. Frank LaRose has erred on, I guess, or what's the word I'm looking for? He's tended to take the cautious route on all of this, despite his claims that he wants to reach as many voters as possible. And, of course, he did mail out the ballot application to all households in Ohio. He resisted, you know, he did not put postage, you know, include postage for absentee ballots. He has limited it to one drop box per county at this point. What do you make of that, Joe Ingles? Where does he sit on all of this?
Well, he said he wanted to do these things, and then there's someone that's prevented him. Either the lawmakers, he didn't think he had the legal ability to do it, and the courts in some of these cases have said, yeah, you got the legal ability. And now he says, well, you know, I don't want to do it now because it's so close to the election, it causes confusion, that sort of thing. I think the thing is that he doesn't want to do anything beyond what he's doing right now. Sending out those absentee ballot application requests actually confused some voters, because some voters had already sent theirs in by the time LaRose had sent them out. So they're sitting there going, wait a minute, did they not get that? I just sent it to them. So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of things that are going on right now that people say they would like to have drop boxes, but if there's not going to be more drop boxes, there always will be that one at the Board of Elections. And the thing to remember, Anne, that I want people to remember is people who have signed up for mail-in voting, and they'll get their ballot in the mail. And they've really sat there and gone, oh, man, I wish I hadn't done that. I really wish I would have gone and early voted in person at the Board of Elections. You can still do that. Don't fill out your ballot. Take your ballot to your local Board of Elections, hand it back to them, and they will let you vote on the machine like you always could. Now, if you go on election day to your precinct, then you have to cast a provisional ballot. Mm-hmm. So it's better off. You're better off to go early and vote early and do that. But, you know, it's still an option for people, and people shouldn't feel like they're pinned into mail-in voting if they're uncomfortable with it. And I've heard a lot of, you know, people say that they really wish that they hadn't signed up to do mail-in voting because they'd really rather go do it in person. So do it in person.
Because why? Are they getting nervous, or do they just want the experience of voting in person? Why are they regretting it?
I think there's a lot of different there are a lot of different reasons people are doing it. But one of them is that people are not familiar with voting on paper, and it makes them nervous that they might make a mistake, and somehow that might be a problem. They're also nervous about the mail system because they hear all these things that happen with the mail system. And, you know, they want to go vote in person. Some people say they just like to go vote in person. They like to know that they voted, that the vote is right there, that it's done. You know, they want to be part of that system. And they were, you know, a lot of people thought, well, it's COVID, maybe I shouldn't go. And that's the reason they, you know, went ahead and got the mail-in ballot. But then since then, I've heard a lot of people say, hey, you know what? I think I'm going to take it in. I'm going to vote early and vote on a regular ballot. And that is absolutely an option for anyone out there who has a mail-in ballot that they decide they want to change their mind. You can change your mind. Take it in. Vote early.
We will continue our conversation. That's Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Also with us, Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch and Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer, Kathy Kandisky of the Columbus Dispatch, and Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. The Supreme Court nomination hearings for conservative Judge Amy Coney Barrett are scheduled to begin October 12th. Senator Rob Portman of Ohio has said that Barrett is not an automatic vote to overturn abortion rights, but the Ohio Right to Life is still waiting in the wings with Senate President Larry Abhoff with a bill to end abortion in Ohio if Roe v. Wade is overturned. The Right to Life president has called it a trigger bill. Jackie Borchardt, do you know what it would do?
I have not seen the legislation. I know this idea has been brought up in the past, and it has not passed in Ohio. Of course, we're in a little bit of a different political time now. So it may be something that, especially if it has the support of the Senate president, something that they pass. But essentially what it does and what it's done in other states that have passed it is it puts language into law so that if Roe v. Wade is overturned and abortion is left to the states, then it would automatically make abortion illegal in Ohio. And I believe a handful or maybe even a dozen states have so-called trigger laws in place. And like I said, previous abortion bills in Ohio have tried to do this and have not. I think the response in the past has been, well, it's not really the time to do that. And of course, now with the court, potentially a 6-3 conservative swing and some cases in the pipeline that mm-hmm. would challenge kind of the states. It's I think the argument too is more of, you know, who should restrict abortion, and you know, the court watchers are anticipating that maybe overturning Roe v. Wade, but some sort of decision that would give the states more leeway in putting more restrictions in place.
I keep trying to say how many more restrictions. I think during the Kasich administration, something like 26 restrictions or something like that were signed into law. What's left, Kathy Kandisky, besides just outright banning it?
That's a good question. And they've been pretty quiet on restrictions for the last year.
Mm-hmm.
The abortions are way down in Ohio. I think the health department report just came out last week showed there was just about 20,000 abortions performed last year. Of course, anti-abortion folks, you know, that's unacceptable to them, but it's happening less and less. They've been successful in getting clinics shut down. I think we're down to only 6 clinics in Ohio where surgical abortions are available. So it's really kind of been diminished in Ohio. But as far as new restrictions, there haven't been any passed in recent months. Although that said, I mean, it's a conservative legislature, House and Senate, and they're certainly open to the idea. I mean, and I would expect, given the change in the makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court, that we might see a more serious look at the trigger law that Jackie was talking about.
Are there the votes for that, Kathy? Clearly? I know restrictions, but...
Right. It's a big step forward for sure. And I guess, you know, to your point, it's not something that they're going to have come up on the floor unless they know that they have the vote.
Right. What do you think, Jackie?
Yeah, I'm not sure where they are. I used to be able to tell you kind of where each representative was on the abortion issue, but there have been quite a few changes in this session as far as, you know, new representatives. Mm-hmm. I would think that the Senate president would introduce a bill that at least he has the support in his caucus to pass, but maybe not. It could be more of a bill to make a statement and get the ball rolling. I'm not sure.
Do you think, Joe Ingles, that Ohio's, you know, that is ready to make this kind of a statement with the trigger bill?
I think with the current makeup of the House and Senate, it's a possibility. I think right now, putting that out there also has a political ramification, because all of these Republicans who are up for reelection, they want people to know where they stand on this issue, because this is a big issue for Republicans. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a key reason we're talking about it now versus later. And I think that, you know, this bill, we haven't really seen what's in it, and we really haven't heard the debate on it. But it is in the general direction that a lot of the representatives and senators have been heading in the past.
I wanted to talk to about a couple of state lawmakers who, it's all so weird. Claremont County Republican Representative John Becker last week tried and failed to charge Governor DeWine with a whole bunch of crimes, including terrorism. What's going on, Jackie Borchardt?
That's a good question. Yeah, Representative Becker has been a sharp critic of Governor DeWine's coronavirus response. And if you'll remember, he also proposed articles of impeachment, which have not gone anywhere. And so he filed a citizen's affidavit in court, in Claremont County Court, saying that, you know, the governor should be charged with all of these things, felonies and misdemeanors. And I had never heard of this citizen's affidavit process, but apparently anybody can go if they believe a crime has been committed and submit such an affidavit. And then it is referred to a prosecutor, who then decides whether they want to pursue charges. And the process, so it went through that process and was assigned to the prosecutor in Claremont County, who is also a Republican. And he decided that it did not, it lacked merit to move forward. So it's done. you know, we asked the governor's office for a comment on this idea, and yeah, they declined, calling it patently absurd. You know, we can't take this seriously. It's not a serious proposal. End of story. You know, the representative has kind of told others, you know, encouraged other people to file affidavits in their local courts. I don't see those going anywhere either, but it is certainly another way to annoy the governor and to kind of get the favor and support of people who are critical of the governor's response.
You know, it kind of makes me wonder, Kathy, about the long-term viability of the Republican Party. I mean, we know that when one party controls so much all of state government, basically, except for a couple slots in the Supreme Court and, you know, a congressperson and, you know, a U.S. senator, you can count it on one
hand. They
start
turning on each other.
Right? They always do. I mean, whatever party's in power to that extent does, but to this extent, to demonize the titular head of the party, which is in Ohio, which is the Republican governor.
Right. It's pretty shocking. I think it speaks to, you know, the what we've seen in the Republican Party, at least in the legislature, where I've been watching more closely over the years. You know, a conservative wing that hasn't been happy. You know, some people talk about moderate Republicans. I don't know how moderate, but just regular garden variety Republicans. There's definitely a real rift there. And as the longer they've gone in control of the state government, the longer you've seen this grow. And you see these more right-wing conservatives, especially in the House, whereas the governor, Republican governors we've had in the last terms, I'm thinking Bob Taft, thinking John Kasich, have tended to be what I would call more center of the road Republicans.
Well, Kasich though signed a lot of bills restricting access to abortion and expanding access to firearms.
But he also expanded Medicaid.
Yes.
So, and there's, I mean, I think we both could argue the point probably pretty effectively, but from at least some policy perspectives, I think he was a little more centrist as well. So it's interesting that you're seeing this. I'm not sure. I just think it speaks to the rift in the Republican Party and how the party's, you know, not really sure what direction it's going in. But I think that'll be made more clear after this presidential election.
And if it's not crazy town enough, Joe Ingles, Democratic state lawmaker Bernadine Kennedy Kent from Columbus endorsed Donald Trump for president last week. She's not even been in the state house for over a year now, right?
Right. She doesn't caucus with the Democrats. There's a real rift between her and the Democrats in the legislature. One thing that I noticed, though, is she was on the plane with President Trump last week and in very close proximity to him without a mask. So, you know, it might be a wise thing for her to get a COVID test right now.
Kennedy Kent is an African-American woman. Jackie Borchardt, you know, can you give us a thumbnail on how the Trump campaign is managing the black voter issue at this point in the game?
Well, the Trump campaign says that, you know, the President Trump has been a great president for black Americans, that black unemployment is low, or at least it was before the coronavirus pandemic, that they have given more funding to historically black colleges and universities, that opportunity zones get mentioned a lot, which is kind of focusing resources into certain areas, tax breaks, tax incentives. All of those things, though, Democrats and will point to and say, well, those are not really moved the needle much, especially the opportunity zones have come under fire from economists as not really benefiting the areas they were intended to benefit, instead benefiting, you know, the businesses involved. And so it's hard because all the polling shows that Black Americans vote Democratic heavily. And that is, you know, obviously Barack Obama was able to win a larger portion of African Americans' votes in 2008 and 2012. Hillary Clinton, especially in Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, didn't have a great turnout necessarily among African Americans. And there was some discussion after the 2016 election that if she had campaigned more in those areas, had done more with Black voters, that she may have performed better and improved her margins or even won in a state like Michigan. So it's a key demographic. It traditionally votes Democratic, but certainly, you know, it's not a group of voters to just take for granted. And I think, you know, Joe Biden has done pretty well with Black voters. We saw with in South Carolina, I think that was kind of the narrative out of that state, that Black voters helped propel him there in the primary. So we'll see. It's one of those, you know, we talk about women in the suburbs. I think Black voters are also an important demographic to watch and see how they engage in this election.
Yeah, so it's really a matter of just getting out the vote at this point. I want to thank you, Jackie Borchardt, for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Jackie Borchardt is a bureau chief for the Cincinnati Enquirer State House Bureau, and also Joe Ingles of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks to you, Joe.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
And Kathy Kandisky, public affairs reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Kathy, nice to have you on again. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That's it. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.